First of all, I absolutely love the book. What a wonderful ride for anybody who is a fan of music, obviously, but history, radio, you name it, you've combined all of those things into this terrific book.
Yeah, many thanks, Rich. It's fun to talk to you about the book. It is, even though I wrote it, I'm so acquainted with the subject matter, when I flip through it, it still amazes me that we had that much talent, that parade of talent that went through here in that short period of time.
And as you point out, probably none of this would have happened had it not been for something completely unrelated to music, the Maine Turnpike.
I'm sure it was outside of their specific intentions. The Turnpike was built as an economic development tool because Maine's declining farm economy had declined. And so this really, I guess, was an outgrowth of that.
Well, as you began to do research on the book, one of the things that you found is that it was a little tough to get information because even the venues didn't really keep much in the way of historical records.
That shocked me. I started thinking this was the Southern Maine concerts were predominantly in Portland, which I quickly learned was wrong. But I thought I'd be able to go into these venues like the Portland Expo or, you know, later, as I got further into this, the two big venues in Lewiston, which was the Armory and Lewiston City Hall, and then the big venues in Old Orchard Beach. I thought I'd be able to go into those places and find a file cabinet full of their posters. And not one of those venues, including, surprisingly, the Cumberland County Civic Center, not one of those venues even has a list of their concerts.
Let's talk about the time frame. You choose 1955, obviously, the Turnpike of what we generally regard also as the start of the rock and roll era, and then 1977, the arrival of the Cumberland County Civic Center, and that really changed things.
It did. The beginning, the 1955 was turned out to be a very easy decision for the start of the book. It's when the Turnpike connected through Lewiston that had previously... as of 1947, it had connected Kittery to Portland, and in 1955 it connected on through, and that's really what put this 250,000 people and 7 college campuses all in one market for concert promoters. But 1955 also coincided with the very first recognized as the very first rock band of all time, Bill Haley and the Comets. And while their song, Rock Around the Clock, which was the first rock and roll song ever, first one ever to make number one on the Billboard national hit list, while it was still number one, they played at Old Orchard Beach in Maine.
And that's a remarkable story, too, to kick off the book, that here you are with the pioneers of rock and roll really kicking off rock concerts in Maine, August of 1955 at the Pier in Old Orchard Beach. And as you point out in the book, there had been performers coming there and coming to Southern Maine venues for years, but as rock arrived, it also created a whole new audience of young people who were not exactly concert goers before this time.
That's correct. I grew up in Southern Maine, and so I was certainly aware that in the big band era, that Count Basie and Tommy Dorsey and Benny Goodman, all those big band names had come to Old Orchard, but it had somehow eluded me that once rock and roll started, it was the same wave of talent was coming through. Actually, with the same promoter. Primarily, it was a promoter named Bobby Selberg from Portland, and then there were two teachers in Biddeford who also were promoters down there. But every weekend in the summer, it was a big rock and roll name playing there in the early and late 60s.
Bobby Selberg is such a hero in this book, and he's got such a unique story in that this was far from his full-time job.
That holds true for all of the concert promoters in this book up until the mid-70s. Bobby Selberg was for 35 years worked on the shipping dock at Sears Roebuck in Portland, and he did these concerts at the Portland Expo, Portland City Hall, and the Palace in Old Orchard Beach as a kind of a hobby. He probably broke even, but it was never enough money for it to be his job, and the same holds true for the other concert promoters in Old Orchard Beach, and then the folks who ran Erebus, which was a big a big fashion store and drug paraphernalia store in the 70s, kind of a trendsetter in southern Maine. Those guys were concert promoters in 69 and 70 and 71, and they didn't make any money at it. It was really a public service.
Well, there's so many wonderful stories in the book. One of the first names that jumped out at me was from 1958, Alan Freed and the parade of rock stars that made their way to Maine. But Alan Freed never made it. Can you share that story?
Yeah, Alan Freed. So the there were two big rock and roll tours that went across the nation and really introduced the nation to rock and roll. Alan Freed in the late 50s, and then Dick Clark in the early 60s. They both came to Maine. Alan Freed came, he was setting the Big Beat tour to Lewiston. Again, 58 is really early in rock and roll, and playing in Lewiston was Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly and the Crickets, Chuck Berry, Frankie Lyman, Danny and the Juniors. I mean, they had song hits that we all know, and they're a big part of rock and roll history. He was supposed to play... was supposed to introduce this parade of talent in Lewiston, but he had lost his job two or three days before because he had the crowd at Boston Garden had gotten so excited that they caused what was characterized as a riot. The mayor of Boston said there would be no more rock and roll concerts as long as he was in control. And they got canceled at a few other venues, but the next act, the next place where they actually performed is a few days later in Lewiston.
And was it the mayor of Lewiston who said, well, listen, we're not Boston. We know how to handle this.
Yeah, he did say that, and they did handle it okay there, but things did melt down at other concerts in Lewiston over the course of time.
As you look through the book and see all these incredible names, it's also interesting to note how many came to Maine before they were really well known on a national basis, probably none bigger than the Supremes.
That's true. And if you think about what these people were doing, these were young people, and they were basically, if they were good enough to get on tour, they were basically on a conveyor belt to go to as many good-sized venues as they could in the whole country as quickly as possible. The Supremes were on that Dick Clark caravan of sound tour, which came to Maine in 64, you know, and that included the Dixie Cups and the Ripcords and Gene Pitney and a number of big names. But the Supremes were on there as one of the 14 acts, but they didn't have a name. They weren't even showing up in local advertising. A month later, they had a hit song, and they right after that became the headliner for Dick Clark, Dick Clark's tour after they left Maine.
We're talking
another
with...
group.
Oh, go ahead.
Another group that found fame that was in Maine before they found fame, and then of course afterwards as well, as the Beach Boys. But they were here in 1963. They played in Old Orchard Beach in 1963. They showed up in a station wagon and a Jaguar, and they had the whole band and their manager and all their equipment stuffed in those two vehicles, towing a U-Haul trailer. And they were just making the rounds. The 62 is really early for the Beach Boys.
We're talking with Ford Reike about his book a long, long time ago, Major Rock and Roll Concerts in Southern Maine, 1955 to 1977. One of the things that makes this book such a joy to look through are the incredible pictures, whether it's posters, ticket stubs, or those rare concert photos. How much work was it finding people who still had these pieces of memorabilia they were willing to share for the book?
Well, luckily, this is a topic that incites passion in people, and so people who were there in the era have, in many cases, kept their materials. So I've got every page of the book is Maine material, although it's obviously national and internationally known names. Everything in the book is 100% Maine based, as you know. So there's 600 images in the book. It's a 200-page book, and I would like to say that a long, long time ago is 100% of the proceeds is being donated to the Maine Historical Society. But I was able to tie. I've met up with old hippies who were fans of these concerts, some of the old concert promoters or their families, the AM DJs, who played a huge role in these concerts because they would promote them and then actually introduce them on stage, and some of the operators of the venues I've been able to talk to as well.
You mentioned the AM radio guys. They were a big part of this, but also local bands are an important part of this story, and as opening acts, but sometimes even stepping to the front when the big-time acts chose not to show up.
That did happen. So it was in the early and mid-60s, these bands that were touring were very low budget, and so they would get booked to play at a facility that might be 2,000, 3,000, maybe 5,000 people. But they were traveling so lightly, they didn't have a backup band. And so they would call ahead and say, listen, get a local high school band or get some popular local band to open for us. So that was very common. I have a lot in the book about the local bands. Loads of high school bands or, you know, garage bands, particularly from the Lewiston area. And sometimes they would think they're going to be the opening act, and then it would turn out that the Birds or the Guess Who would fail to show up completely, and these poor young people would end up spending the whole night trying to entertain a crowd who thought they were going to be seeing a big name.
We have
Jimi Hendrix in Lewiston, which I think might be the most, if you ask me, the most significant concert in Southern Maine. It would probably be Jimi Hendrix playing in 1968 at the Lewiston Armory. Jimi Hendrix was supposed to be bringing a backup band. It was a band from England called Soft Machine, and they had kind of a cult following. But when they crossed the border on tour from Canada into Maine, they had a drug violation and they got detained. And so Jimi Hendrix showed up in Lewiston without a backup band and without half of his amplifiers, and they had to get a local band called Terry and the Telstars to open for Jimi Hendrix. And Jimi Hendrix had to borrow their Fender amps, which were microscopic compared to what Jimi Hendrix normally played with on stage.
There were some interesting incidents along the way. And we've talked to so many musicians on our show who were part of this story as well. I wish I had known the story of what happened with Herman's Hermits when we had Peter Noone on.
Yeah, I'm not sure he would remember that very fondly, but it's an interesting story. He was playing, I think it was in 1966 in Portland. It was at the Portland Expo. There were probably a couple thousand or maybe 3,000 people there, and they were three songs into their set when a fan in the front part of the crowd had a full cup of Pepsi and threw it on stage and hit him head on. And he got so mad, he stormed off the stage, and they left. The band followed him off, and that was the end of the night.
Also a pretty wild time when Freddie Mercury and Queen came to the state.
That was, as I alluded to a moment ago, Lewiston had some really signature events with these early rock and roll concerts. Big names came to Lewiston, partly because Lewiston had bigger venues than anything in Maine early on. They could seat 5,000 people at the Lewiston Armory, and then after that got shut down because of bad behavior, the concert promoters went over to the Central Maine Youth Center, where they could seat 6,500 people by putting plywood down on the ice of the hockey rink. So Queen came to play. At the Lewiston Armory in 74 or 75, I think it was 75, they blew into town in a white limousine and went to the local FM radio station and just walked into the station and kind of commandeered the show without any forewarning. And then at the night of the concert, there was what the police characterized as a riot. I think there were 25 arrests. They fished some kid out of a basketball hoop. He'd been stuffed in the basketball hoop. And two people were having sex in an all-glass phone booth, and that was kind of the last straw for the city council. They really started shutting down on the concerts after that.
Where was that white limousine when our friend Alice Cooper came to Portland?
That's exactly right. Alice Cooper showed up earlier, a few years earlier, and he played for the University of Southern Maine. And I will say these colleges played a huge role in bringing these bands to Maine. University of Southern Maine, of course, I went to Orono. I was the same deal up there. But colleges attracted many of these big names. So Alice Cooper showed up at the airport, I think it was 71 or 72, pretty early in the game, and hit, to play for University of Southern Maine. This concert was being put on by student promoters who didn't have much in the way of resources. And it was a rider in Alice Cooper's standard performance contract that they get picked up by white limousines at whatever airport they're flying into. And so in this case, a black limousine showed up, and Alice Cooper would not even get in it. So the two students had to take their Volkswagen Bug out to the Portland Jetport, which was just the airport at the time, and convince them that if they didn't get in the limo, they're going to be riding something a lot less attractive, even though it was a black limo.
Well, we're lucky you're here to tell the tale for it. All that in spite of the backhanded efforts of the young bloods who nearly cost you your life.
Yeah, that was like a lot of people. One way that I got punished as a teenager in that period was for me to lose my driving privileges, and so the young bloods showed up in Portland. That was, I think there are 1,500 people at the State Theater for that concert, and it was a big deal when these bands were coming to towns. Like, I'm sure it was the same in the Bangor area and Waterville, but when they were coming to Southern Maine towns back in the late 60s and 70s, it was front page news. Everybody knew about it. So there was a concert at the State Theater, and the young bloods flew into town an hour and a half late. So, you know, we were high school students, and concert started an hour and a half late, and we got home an hour and a half late, and I got grounded. And long story, I think I got grounded for a couple of weeks. But long story short, the day I got my car keys back, or my parents' car keys back, I went out, and 2 hours later, I was in a car accident, drove off a bridge into the Presumpscot River. It was one of those amazing car accidents, amazing anyone could live through it. But I said in the book that I wouldn't have gotten grounded if the young Reds hadn't been showing up late that night, and I wouldn't have come so near death.
Man, oh man, we're talking with Ford Reike. His book is called The Long, Long Time Ago. So many great photos in the book. And as you explain, these photos largely coming from people who were in the audience, whoever it was that took photographs of the Ike and Tina Turner show, did a fantastic job. Those are some of the best photos in the entire book.
Yeah, that's true. These photos were cameras were not tightly restricted. But over the course of time, promoters just wouldn't let it happen because they wanted to control all the photography and all the publicity. Actually, when the band America played, their contract writer had a requirement that any photos that were taken for publicity purposes had to be taken with a Nikon camera only. But people smuggled cameras in. They also smuggled in reel-to-reel tape recorders. I have access to a number of those from a fellow named Joe Maloney, who was a local who recorded those things. And people kept them because these are important parts of our lives. And luckily, I got my hands on a bunch of great scrapbooks.
People up north still talk about the fact that Bruce Springsteen played at Little Ricker College earlier in his career, but he also made an appearance at the Central Maine Youth Center in early 1977.
He did. Some of these acts ended up being monster names, but earlier in their career, they'd play anywhere where they could put together 500 or 1,000 people. But Springsteen played later in the 1970s in Lewiston, Maine, and he played at the Central Maine Youth Center, which was a hockey arena. His dressing room, by this time he was pretty famous, his dressing room was the stinky locker room, and his road manager freaked out when he saw it. He made the promoters, who were a couple of young guys, go out and get curtains and paint and a rug at some discount store to try to dress the locker room up for Springsteen.
So many wonderful stories in the book, so many great pictures as well, and memories. It was just an absolute delight to read through the whole thing. And we talked about the Cumberland County Civic Center and how that helped mark the end of this journey. What changed? Was it, it wasn't just the size of the venue, but also the arrival on the scene of more regional and national promoters?
Yeah, you are correct. So we talked about the Queen concert in Lewiston in 75. Lewiston had the big venues for Southern Maine up before the Civic Center, but Lewiston just shut down concerts. They'd had it. So you were running out, coincidentally, running out of the access to the big venues, And then the Civic Center opened in Portland in 1977. It could seat almost twice as many people as the biggest venue in southern Maine. It could seat almost 10,000 people. When it opened, it was characterized in New England as a rock palace. There was nothing else in northern New England that large. It was, and so it really got on the map for the big tours. But things, and when that happened, it shut down the other venues, effectively shut all of them down, and brought so much more big name talent to Maine. The year before the Civic Center opened, there were 16 significant concerts in southern Maine. The year it opened, there were 45.
Wow. So
basically, the names elevated in stature, and the number of concerts tripled. And it coincided with the end of that kind of that quaint era where you had the local concert promoters doing it as a public service. The local tickets, no more paper tickets. Electronic ticketing came in the same year. And so you're buying that from national concert ticket sales outfits instead of your local record store. And it just coincidentally was an era when a lot changed. And so it became a logical spot for me to end the book.
Now that the book is out, and you were telling me it's sold very well, over 1,000 copies sold already, are you finding that you're hearing from even more people who have got pictures, tickets, posters, and the like to share?
So good and bad news on that. The bad news is I was hoping to round up more. I guess the good news is it means I covered things pretty well with the first printing. I only came across one concert and one poster that I didn't have in the book. We're actually doing a second printing. We only have been selling for a month, and we've sold 1,100 copies, which for a Maine history book is really quite surprising. So we're doing a second printing and arranging that right now.
Well, it's a wonderful book. Anybody who loves music, the history of Maine, will absolutely enjoy every moment they spend with a long, long time ago, major rock and roll concerts in southern Maine. Ford, thanks so much for visiting with us today. Wish you continued success with the book and the great work it's doing for the Maine Historical Society. And thanks again for visiting.
Yeah, thank you so much. I enjoyed our talk.